Hello everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand fan page for Song of Ice and Fire, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me is, as always...
is Sean T. Collins. I am a TV critic for various publications, and I cover Game of Thrones in that capacity for Rolling Stone, the New York Observer, and Vulture. I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and a Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones fan site located at boiledleather.com, which is where this podcast is hosted. And I am the co-author with one of our guests today of the official annotated Game of Thrones with series editor Ann Grohl and Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and the World of Ice and Fire, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Elio and Linda Antonsen are with us, and I'm super excited to sort of pick their brains about the year of Ice and Fire. You know, the book came out last autumn, so it's been over a year now. And I just was looking through some of the stuff I wrote about the book when it came out and remembered that one of the reasons we didn't do a podcast on it right away is because I couldn't actually get my recording stuff to work because I had an old computer and Skype was no longer compatible with it, which was fun. But in a way, I'm kind of glad it worked out that way because we have the benefit of hindsight and we don't have to compete with all the other people who interviewed you guys. So thanks for joining us after all this time. I really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.
Absolutely our pleasure.
So what has the last year been like since the book came out? Like how was the reception?
Wow, it's been, I mean,
very unexpected in many ways. We kind of expected a lot of the attention to come as the book was published initially in 2014 in the autumn there, and it sort of lagged behind a bit, and then we ended up getting all these requests during the spring of 2015 is where we got a lot of the requests to do various presentations here in Sweden and presentations abroad, and when the various foreign editions started cropping up. So it kind of built up slowly. It turned out that we thought, oh, we'll be done with most of the press work and such by the summer, and no.
Oh, that's cool.
This has been our most traveled past year. I mean, we went to Spain, to Barcelona for the release of the book, and then we went from Gigamesh at the Gigamesh store. The Spanish fans are, you know, they're crazy and amazing people. And we went then to the town of Osuna, where they filmed part of the fifth season, where we kind of did the official release day was there in Osuna. So we were put up in just fabulous little hotel, you know, boutique hotel, and the book was debuted in like a 15th century university building, and then we traveled to Visby for the medieval week, and spoke there in the ruins of a cathedral. It was such a strange time.
We spoke together with George at the Livrustkammaren in Stockholm at
the Royal Armory.
The Royal Armory. And so we had a presentation that was the first time ever. That was sort of the world premiere for us talking about the book together with George. And the first signatures of all three people were produced there and for the SF bookstore in Stockholm. And then we also did a presentation at
Åland,
at the convention there in Mariehamn, Archipelago. Yes. Yeah.
So no, it's been amazing, and people have been so awesome, I mean, about it. We've had so much discussion, so many questions, of course. One of the first things I was doing was fielding all the error reports from people. Is this like a mistake? And a little mistake. And there were things that were there were genuine mistakes, and like there are mistakes that are like intended mistakes because you know the whole device that we use in writing this, that there are going to be mistakes because the person writing this doesn't know everything.
Right.
But at the same time, there are mistakes where we're like, yeah, we didn't intend that to happen. So I mean, there's been corrections sent back and forth, and I think the fourth print is out or should be out, and that has some more corrections, but. It's been a very busy and amazing year for us, yeah.
So it sounds like it's, I mean, I know it certainly was by the two of us, but it sounds like the book was really embraced by the fandom then, if you're...
I would say 95% of the people who bought it, understanding what it was, because there are some people, when you look at the early Amazon reviews saying, I thought this was the continuation of the Song of the Fire series.
Oh, no, not just the early ones. I still pop in and look at reviews occasionally.
Yeah.
And you're like, this reads like a history book. It's not a story.
Yeah, okay.
It might be because it's a history book.
Let's see. A history book, I think the majority of people that we've seen and have spoken to us and or we've, you know, we Google online and see what people are saying, were saying and such. Most of them really liked it. There are people who had issues.
There was people who are, you know, interested in other parts. They might feel that, you know, I wish there was more about, you know, Essos or the, you know, the annoying maester wouldn't say that, oh, we're not really touching on that. That was the things I wanted to know and such. So, you know, I already knew that they'll say things like, you know, I already knew all of the other stuff. And of course, if they, you know, gotten the book late and been reading on various wikis and people discussing it, then the information was known already to them. So then, you know, they might get the impression that this was all existing information. So, but, you know, that's the nature of any reference work. I imagine that it may not reference exactly what you wanted to reference.
Yeah. That's an interesting point about how stuff gets out online now. I was just thinking about that with regards to Star Wars and, you know, when the film came out, I had just been on the wiki for some reason, I think looking up something for one of our kids. And I was like, man, all the information that's going to come out in this film, they have to figure out when they're going to put it up and when it's going to go live on the wiki, and people are going to complain about, you know, the balance that you have to walk with, you know, actually making work, and then the whole infrastructure of discussion that goes on online around it. You know, that's...
No, I mean, we obviously had that with the wiki as well, that we wanted to have a bit of a little window where we basically say you can't add the information yet to the wiki because, you know, it should have some exclusivity period. And
there's an opportunity. I think we did like 1 month or something.
Yeah, I think
it seemed reasonable, I think. And I think people, the editors have kind of accepted that as a reasonable amount of time. But obviously you can't keep it forever. And part of the pleasure of the book, I think, or is it doesn't matter if, like, the wiki has the factual content up. It's sort of reading and seeing how it's presented and seeing how the layers, the interlocking layers of sort of, he's referencing this scholar who's referencing this thing which happened thousands of years ago and no one's witnessed it, and then, or he's making this claim and you can realize that there are political motives that are, or, you know, political imperatives that are preventing him from maybe exactly saying what everyone knows to be true. So I think, and then of course it's a beautiful book. I mean,
the whole thing sort of being put together the way it is, gives it some value outside of the information, I should imagine. And, I mean, I was surprised, admittedly, when now the Wheel of Time, is it, what do they call it? Companion or?
Companion.
Yeah. Obviously, that's much more of a traditional encyclopedia. And that, I think, is much more in danger of being superseded by online because you are presenting it just sort of straight up facts. So I'm glad that we didn't end up with that structure. I'm glad that it moved away from, and that's being handled by the app instead.
Yes.
Right, right. Yeah, because, I mean, it is, it's a coffee table book, you know, for whatever else it is, you know, and it's the kind of thing that holds up to, you know, owning and reading just in that respect.
Yeah, no, George definitely had the right feel about that.
For sure, yeah.
I'm stressing all the time that it should be, you know, lots of art, more art. You know, get those mails all the time. what about the art for this? I've got art sorted out for this, and this really needs to be depicted.
You know, when I think back about the time just before the book came out, so let's talk about the quarter of the year before it came out, and no one really knew what it was going to be like. There was obviously a lot of discussion, and some of this discussion back then was pretty vitriolic in parts. And I think you will remember that kind of stuff. You know, it's just glorified fanfic or whatever. So what my question to you guys is, because somehow I wanted to ask you this for a long time now, how did you react to this line of attack, and how do you feel about it, and how would you defend against it if you do at all?
Well, I think it was Damon Knight who once was quoted as saying about, you know, I can't define what science fiction is, but I know, you know, it's what I point at. You know, it's so fan fiction. What is fan fiction? Yeah. Everyone has different definitions of what exactly.
I mean, and they change all the time because, you know, George obviously went out and said on the live journal, you know, it's really moronic to call it fan fiction. And coming from where he is, you know, he has a very strong idea of, he says that, you know, I used to write fan fiction, but what we called fan fiction then, that was, you know, original fiction written by fans and sent into the various fanzines and
amateur
writing, basically just amateur writing. Now it has an entirely different meaning, and it's
what I would say is so I mean, obviously George doesn't see it as fan fiction, and we never saw it as fan fiction. And because I mean, the part that people don't really understand is that, or at least a lot of people didn't understand at the time, was so much of the information in it is from George, one way or the other. Either he wrote it directly, and I mean, I'd say 50% of the book is directly written by George. The other 50% is written by us, but a lot of it is stuff where we have taken stuff that George has written, and we have we've squeezed it down. We've, you know, to fit the format, or it's literally information that exists in the novels and in things that George has told us, or in notes, and we've just put it down. So we're just recording. So it's for us, like, is it fan fiction? Like, you know, we're not really presenting any original narrative. No. We're not presenting a story.
The one I hit on telling people a lot when we were out presenting stuff is that, you know, we curated the information. We were curators of George's information from the book, as in we collected it, we structured it in a way, and then with the additional material that he provided, we curated that in a sense. We selected, we put together. So we're not really creating. There are places where we had to bridge, you know, from point A to B where there wasn't anything, and we sort of had to provide a natural bridge. But none of that is, you know, story creating. And, you know, personally, I tend to take a fairly narrow view of, as in, what fan fiction is, in the sense that, you know, there's so many different types of fan works. And if you've got the overall umbrella of fan works, then fan fiction for me is, that is writing stories. And 95% of the time, it is writing stories that involve, you know, the characters. So they have to be actual in the narrative format, and they have to involve the characters that the author created. If you're just writing something set in the world and you're not really using any of the characters, you're coming closer to just sort of narrating a role-playing campaign, I think.
Yeah.
If it's entirely original with the characters and you're just saying, well, this is set in Westeros, but, you know, there are no Tyrians or no Sansas or whatever. But the complete lack of, you know, a story and narrative, I don't think you can have a history book that is fan fiction.
No. Yeah, I don't share this line of argument. Yeah. I just wanted to.
It's an interesting question. I mean,
we've always been sort of dogged a little bit by it, because, I mean, we always took a very hard line on fan fiction on Westeros.org, in the sense that we don't. I mean, George doesn't like it.
Yeah,
approve of it, and so we didn't want people to say, "Oh, no, we're not going to give you a sub forum where you can post your fan fiction. We're not going to have people sharing fan fiction on our forums." And at the same time, we had this role playing game, it's an online text based role playing game that George approved. And people have to say, "Oh, well, you guys type one another, you're creating stories, kind of. So isn't that fan fiction?" And like, well, George approved it. He doesn't approve of fan fiction. So obviously, in George's mind, it's not fan fiction. When George is talking about fan fiction, he's talking about people doing the kind of stuff that he himself does, which is write narratives.
50 Shades of Grey, basically.
Yeah, and in particular, using his characters.
Yeah, that was like a big thing when he asked about the role-playing game way back when, was like, you know, we're not going to use your characters. It's not going to be set in the period of the books. You know, there's no Ned Stark. No one's going to be running around pretending they're Jon Snow. We'll set it in the past. And so that way, you know, you mention the characters. You haven't really developed anything. And he's like, that was okay. But it's like, are LARPers creating fan fiction when they LARP in Westeros? They're not really. I mean, it's play. It's a game. It's not the same thing that fiction gets at.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, you could, yeah, no, I think it's, a lot of people blur all the different kinds of fan works together. I mean, George is obviously perfectly fine, you know, with
fan art.
Fan art, as long as it's, you know, you're not selling it and things like that. So, the fact that people find it difficult to keep each of those sort of branches distinct, whereas obviously George, coming from a role-playing background, sees a distinct difference between writing stories and creating a narrative through a role-playing campaign.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's such a, I mean, just thinking about it now, we could probably dedicate an entire episode just to this issue, you know, because it's a fraught one, I think, and... I tend to take a more negative view of fan fiction or just sort of fan fiction's nature and presence in fandom communities as something that kind of takes away the focus from it diminishes the importance of the original artist as a laborer, you know. That's very important to me, coming from comics, where a lot of the people who created these characters that are now the source of multi-billion-dollar in multiple industries, you know, never really got their fair share and are just kind of dismissed and in some cases not even remembered. You know, but at the same time, you see fan fiction used just as an epithet for stuff not done by the original creator that we're not nuts about, or even stuff done by, I saw an argument that the prequel trilogy for Star Wars was fan fiction by George Lucas. And it's like, at that point,
that you'll have to bend over in some weird ways. And
Right. Now, I mean, you may not like what he did, but that seems weird. And to me, the defining characteristic of The World of Ice and Fire was George's involvement from soup to nuts. And, you know, whether he wrote every individual word, it seemed like by sort of generating the idea, you know, generating pretty much all the ideas. It was his work, you know.
Yeah. No. I mean, you make a very interesting point there, I think, isn't the Star Wars comparison, in the sense that it seems to be when it doesn't fit their idea that they've developed about something, they want to put it outside. And that's where you got these weird situations where you've got people feeling that their, you know, head canon is somehow, I mean, concept just weirds me out, actually, I have to admit. And that somehow is superior to the actual canon, so that, you know, if a writer writes something and then you have a while until the next production comes out, or, you know, in the case of the Star Wars, you know, a long wait for those prequels, people have got this, you know, some people have this head canon about how it was supposed to be. And then what he produces doesn't match it. And all of a sudden they say, well, we're going to dismiss it. It's not really canon because it didn't fit what we had imagined.
And to be honest, I mean, some of the fan fiction stuff beforehand was, you know, annoying enough, but there were people who stuck to their guns on this position. Like, after it came out, they saw what it was, because, and it was very clear for some people, like, the things it had to say that touched on certain, like, big important theories that people had didn't fit with what they wanted, so they had to find a way to dismiss it so that they, you know, sort of ideas weren't in danger, which is a very odd thing.
People can get very attached to their view of a story.
Right. Especially,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, I was just going to say, especially in a story like this where so much of the reader relationship with the work is about trying to piece things together and figure things out. I mean, even if you're not like an obsessive clue hunter, you know, the story's not finished. So of course people are going to be thinking and planning and plotting and trying to figure stuff out. So in a way you're laying down markers that people weren't necessarily prepared to to actually flip over and see what the card said, you know?
Yeah. No, what I was saying that was that when the news came out of the Winds of Winter not being finished before the sixth season comes out, and obviously, you know, we already knew before then that the seventh book certainly wouldn't be out before the series finished all over on TV. Mm-hmm. But I saw a couple of tweets from author Guy Gabriel Kay, and he's tweeted on it before, sort of commenting as an author on how strange it must be for George to be in this situation. And since I've followed him and exchanged a few tweets in the past, I, you know, commented on it again, and I said, it led to me saying that I think that in particular, this sort of story with the world building, that it has a particular impact when you have this sort of fan community with so much to discuss, and you can have these massive revelations about the world and about the plot and the characters. So it's not just on one level of, you know, you're revealing plot. There are all these things that people are going to sort of, you know, immediately gravitate towards finding out more and picking apart. And, okay, is this how George intended it, or is it going to be something else? So the type of story is very conducive to people having, you know, a lot of speculations about the facts, the details. Yeah. And then because they think a lot about it, they develop very specific ideas sometimes.
Yeah, because it's not like, you know, let's say this book came out between the release of The Two Towers and The Return of the King or something like that, and it was about Tolkien's world. It would work differently because the narratives were much more straightforward. They were the actual mechanics of the storytelling relied less on gaps of information. It's a very different beast. And that reminds me, was there anything that took you guys by surprise when you started working on this, when you found things out from George? Was there anything that, that you didn't see coming?
Wow. Originally when we planned this, the idea was George would just give us notes. Like we'd send him drafts and he'd see gaps of information, or we'd ask him and he'd send us notes. Cause, you know, way back when we started our game, George sent us notes on heraldry, and then notes on like the reign of, you know, of the reigns of, you know, Daeron the Young Dragon through Aegon the Unworthy, and like breakdowns of notable events and the mistresses of Aegon. He sent, so we thought, oh, he must have bunches of these kinds of notes. And in fact, what it turned out is he didn't really, it was an unusual thing for him to have made those notes in the first place. So then that's where the whole thing came. Well, I'll do little sidebars. I don't do notes. So you sent me your first run, and I'll do little one page sidebars or little one paragraph sidebars just to fill in gaps for you. And those sidebars grew into the massive text that eventually became so massive that, if we had published everything written for the book in one volume, the book would have been like three times its size, because George wrote lots. The top of them was, you know, The Dance of the Dragons was like 70,000 words on just The Dance of the Dragons. And we couldn't put that all into the book. So that was, I think, the first really big surprise when we realized, like, George was serious about it. He doesn't do notes, and that when he starts writing, like, when he's on fire, it just can come out like that. World building is obviously for those, you know, the writing he did for this book is very different from the kind of writing he does for the novels. It's much more straightforward in a lot of ways. This is because it's not about, you know, the complex psychologies of characters and just getting the dialogue-ness just right and all those details. It's a fairly straightforward historical account. And
I should say that going at the speed that we were going at the end, where he was submitting, you know, the last pieces, is unfortunately where some of the continuity errors crept in, because he didn't have time, because the deadline that we were running up against, he wrote it, and then the idea was to check between each section that everything lined up, which turned out to be a lot more complicated than I think George had imagined.
Well, you know, the thing with the timeline or the continuity is he wrote large chunks of the histories of the various kingdoms, right? The prehistory prior to Aegon. And he had kind of cross-referenced them all with each other for the most part. Until at the very end, he did the enormous Ironborn section, and he kind of forgot to do that. And suddenly the Ironborn narrative.
And they interact with everyone.
That's the thing. If there was one group of people you wanted not to be at the very end, it would have been the Ironborn, because they literally interact with the North, the West, the Reach.
The Riverlands.
Yeah. So that price for headache and some of the errors that kind of do exist are specifically because of that problem. The other surprise for us was when we did Aegon the Fifth. Now, there we had a conference call with George to try and get some information from him about Egg, to put into the Aegon the Fifth section, because we had very little about his reign, right? And George did have some notes, because he has notes for, ideas for future Duncan Egg stories. And so we had a conversation about, and he was trying to decide what he could share with us and what he couldn't share with us. And he was like, I can't share that bit. Don't say that. Don't go. So we did this first run of it, and then we sent it to him. And everything that he told us in that conversation not to put in, he decided to put in after the fact. Really funny. It's really funny. And at the same, it's kind of cool because it emphasizes one thing that I always tell people about the series, which is for George, it's not really about the destination. It's not and this happens. It's the whys. How does it affect people? The human heart and conflict with itself, and how that is expressed in a narrative. So we may know that Dunk will be fighting a single combat against the Laughing Storm, who has proclaimed himself king of the Stormlands. But the emotions, the actual how Dunk felt about it, how Egg felt about it, we don't know that, and that's the important part of what, if George ever gets to writing that story into a new novella. And it's the same with Osar as a Fire. We may believe very fully, but we know what happened with Jon Snow's parentage, but we don't know. To me, it's the why. Did that happen? And how did those characters involved in it? How did they come to this happening? That to me is the thing I'm really interested in, because it's quite mysterious.
You know, it is such a huge relief to hear you say this, because this is a line of argument that Sean and I are always having on the podcast when we discuss fan theories and such. You know, that the narrative and all these developments and such are the most important part. So it is really great to hear you guys say the same. But the question I wanted to ask when you're talking about Aegon the Fifth here, how much in the book did you have to deliberately leave out? You know, how many blank spaces were there where Martin said it's just hands off, where he has a big secret that you might or might not know? Summerhall, for example, seems very much like one of those very deliberate blank
spaces. Yes, that was from the start. That was the big one that came up right away, I think, when we talked about having a maester write it. It was immediately, we need to have an ink spill on that page or something. so that was the number one example.
Summerhall specifically. And as I said, we do have these sort of the garble little snippets of text that George provided us. People have a little bit more idea of what happened there than they did before, but it's not like they now know the whole story. It's tantalizing.
And magic, there wasn't really much he wanted to provide about, the others or any of the magic.
Ashai.
Ashai we got more than we expected. Yeah. So I think that there, I don't know that George has much more ideas about what Ashai is. It's more like what it might possibly be involved in, or how it might involve itself in the story. But certainly, we weren't going to get anything more about any of the magic that is directly relevant to the story, how it works, or any of these things. Those are definitely things he's sitting on.
We're
just removing our little doggy from the room.
Oh, okay.
He's involved in the...
Yeah, not so little.
Though.
Oh, coming back. Hopefully, let us know if his chewing on his bone gets too loud, and we'll get too distracting. The other thing about Aegon, the other thing George didn't really want to get into personally was a detailed account of Robert's Rebellion, all the events, because he said there are things he was still fleshing out in his mind about the events. And at the same time, he didn't want to, and the things that he had solid, he didn't necessarily want to reveal to people. He wanted to reveal them in the books. Like, that was the big thing for George. I have things I want to reveal in the novels and not in this book.
Things he was searching, we're going to go into the novels. Like, you know, obviously we're going to find out more about Robert's Rebellion. And it's interesting because that shaped the final section of the book, quite obviously, because it was a contention point sort of for us for a while. We were discussing that we didn't quite know, okay, how are we going to deal with this? How is our maester going to write this narrative, which is near past, and not do it in detail? So Elio actually attempted one version of Robert's Rebellion that was as detailed as he could get it. And then we hit on the idea that, well, hang on. He is presenting this text. He's already had to edit the dedication twice. And it's no longer being presented to Robert. It's not being presented to Joffrey. It's being presented to Tommen. And with Tywin alive, I think was our view of it when the book was published, at least. Mm-hmm. So can he really have this detailed account of Robert's Rebellion with the heroic Robert and the heroic Ned and the heroic Stannis? No. So, right. Oh yeah, this solves the problem of the incomplete Robert's Rebellion, because he will just have to present a really edited version that kind of just focuses on what Tywin did. So just stripping out, you didn't have to have all the account about Ned, and so it kind of solved itself in terms of the context that Leandel probably doesn't want to get his head chopped off. So
yeah, so that's the explanation for, like, originally we had the idea, we wanted it to be that, like, we suggested, like, could we have the parchment texture of a different color for just that section? To kind of indicate, like, he had come to King's Landing, he had this whole book, and then Ned got, you know, his head chopped off as a traitor, there's a whole thing going on, and he said, okay, I need to cut out my original Robert's Rebellion, and I need to kind of do a quickly redacted one, but there's, you know, removes the stuff that might offend the Lannister family. So that was very fortuitous. I mean, we couldn't actually do the parchment thing. That didn't happen, but that was the idea anyway that I do.
He inserted those pages afterwards.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite things about the book is how often the, you know, the sort of dual framework of A, having it written from the perspective of in-world characters, in-world maesters, and B, the situation where you had to kind of elide or hide or, you know, just simply not include certain information to avoid spoiling, you know, future volumes of the main series or Duncan Egg or whatever, is how often you made those gaps work for you in terms of the entertainment value of the book. Like, I wrote a great deal when the book came out, both in Rolling Stone and then on Boiled Leather, about the Deep Ones, you know, this mysterious race of prehistoric fish people. It's not something, I mean, it's there, obviously, and it's noticeable, but it's so much cooler and feels so much more exciting as a reader to be like, wait a minute, and, like, you know, flip back through the pages and be like, the oily black stone, that's in the Hightower, and that's in, you know, and that's in Meen, too, and all these things where you're flipping back and forth. You know, if it had all been laid out in, like, you know, Deep Ones, comma, the, in the D entry in the encyclopedia, it would have been boring. But this way, it involves you and it's exciting to read.
Exactly. Part of the thing we did also, I mean, that's an example. That's like, that's all George, the Deep Ones. Anything that's like a Lovecraft reference, that's George. But there are things like when he wrote, like, the Dance of Dragons material for us, and that has a very long narrative or a very long account of that conflict. What we would do with things like that is, like, rather than just say, okay, now we're going to do our Dance of Dragons section, we would say, well, look, there's stuff here about what, you know, the Red Kraken was doing. Let's actually just kind of hint at it when we're writing about the conflict. And let's then, in the Greyjoy section, let's actually work in some of that information.
Yeah. So we can redistribute the information so that if George had a Targaryen section, which also happened to touch on all these other regions, we would often break out the information that were, had mainly to do with the other regions and come back to that in other sections, so that trying to spread the material around so that we didn't just provide a super condensed version of what he wrote. And so that it would be, because, you know, he did talk fairly early on, I think, about using it for another book, and then, you know, okay, we'll try and use it in a different way and really treat it like our maester has found this other work by Maester Gildane. And he is not just going to do a summary of it, you know, step by step. He's going to treat it as a reference work where he pulls in information where he needs it.
It gives the book, I don't know, there's a verisimilitude to that, the way that works, that makes it, you know, I mean, I said this at the time, to me, it's like a fun book to read, you know, not just as a reference where you flip through and find cool things about stuff that you already had read about and liked. You know, it works as its own sort of, you know, experience. And that was one of the main elements to that, I thought.
Yeah, and a lot of it, I think, I mean, we were lucky in some aspects how it developed, that it, you know, it took a lot longer than it should have, but that because, you know, George was busy, and since, you know, he didn't have those notes to send us, we had to wait until he could actually write, it turned out. And then we just had to, some of the things we had to sort of develop along the way. I mean, we always had the ideas that it's going to be, you know, an in-world account, partially so that we can avoid certain things. And then other things, you know, the idea with our maester referencing George's maester developed entirely out of necessity when he provided all that material. And it turned out, I think, to be a, you know, a great way of doing it. So in some ways we were lucky that we had the time to allow it to develop like that. And when something, and when the situation changed, we could sort of think about, okay, how does this work with what we're doing?
And it, I'm glad you brought that up too, and the nature of using George's contributions, direct contributions, as its own, as a separate, you know, character sort of. Because one thing, another thing that I really liked about the book was that I felt like it, even within the larger framework of the world of Ice and Fire and the world that we already knew, it was a way for him to inject stuff that didn't fit either with the story he was telling in the main series or with the sort of the specific kind of epic fantasy he was tweaking in the main series. You know, all of a sudden, like, that other, the all kinds of weird stuff that he's talked about, you could put that into this, you know, let's say most, like, primarily Tolkien indebted world, so that now there's like Robert E. Howard land and H.P. Lovecraft, you know, species and stuff, and I really liked seeing that. And then I think it's a similar principle with, let's say, the lengthy Targaryen histories. You know, obviously he has other, you know, I assume that's still true, and that he has other even grander plans for that material. But it just was nice to see that there was a way for him to incorporate all these different kinds of things, these different kinds of stories, different eras, different tones, different almost genres within the larger work.
He obviously enjoyed that quite a bit. We didn't expect that much on Essos in particular. Mm-hmm. You know, we had some fairly sparse notes that we had been able to put together from what was already in the books. And then some of the sections grew a lot. And I mean, the interesting thing is we talked a bit about this at the Royal Armory, I think, which was that it kind of came out of the lands of Ice and Fire. Because, you know, his publisher approached him and said, we want to publish, you know, poster-sized maps in a book. And George thought, you know, well, great, the maps already exist. You blow them up, and you put them in a poster book, and I don't have to do anything because I'm busy writing a book. Well,
famous last words.
When they blew up the map, the world map, and the map of Essos in particular, they pointed out, George, it's very empty when you make it large. There's like the Dothraki Sea and Vase Dothrak and Karth. That's kind of it. And there's this huge landmass. Could you make up some places? So George had to do some work, and he had to make up all these names and things. And I forget, did he send, was that being sent to us as well? We saw some of that where he was
I was coming back from a press junket for the third season, I guess, in London. Yeah. And George was mailing us scans of, and he the map he was doing, he does it on just standard sheets of paper, and basically when he runs out of space, or then he goes adds a paper.
He
next
tapes
to
on
it.
A paper.
And so we saw the whole process there of him kind of creating things, and it was all it was just
he was having fun, like when he was creating the heraldry.
Yeah.
Basically, he'd sit and do heraldry and house mottos and house shields when he was watching football. And now he started doing all these weird and wonderful places to fill out the map. And then when we got to the world of Ice and Fire, I don't know if it was us or Anne.
I think it was Anne
who very rudely, but pointed out to George, I shouldn't say rudely, but she reminded him that, George, you have all these names,
the Lands of Ice and Fire,
which we made you add to the Lands of Ice and Fire. Now you have to write something about them. So not only did he end up having to invent all these places for the map, then he had to come up with more details about
them. He had
some ideas, and a lot of the ideas, I think, came out of the names.
Yeah, he would have notes, each map section that he sent us was coming with notes commenting what this is and that. And so we were planning to use that for our very, very brief Essos section. It's just a little sketch of the East. But George greatly expanded on it.
Like all those emperors he ended up making for E.T.
And that again, I'm sorry if I'm hugging the questioning here, but that actually wound up tying pretty directly into one of the most important threads of the main series, because as you learn more about these cities and lands and cultures that are increasingly distant from Westeros, that's when you start to see the echoes of the legend of the Long Night, and the savior figure who rose against some unnamed evil force, or not unnamed, but in different cultures, the evil force had a different name, came from a different place, had a different origin story, but it's the same basic template over and over.
Oh, we were excited when we started coming across that.
Yeah, oh yeah,
That was like little mini Christmases every time. You're like, it's five forts. Wow, they have like their own wall, and Hukum the hero and all these things.
Right.
It was definitely very exciting when we realized that George had decided to seed more legends, so that there is something going on, that whatever's happening on this side of the world, there's probably something mirroring it on the other side of the world. So it adds a lot more, you don't have to, it's that, iceberg analogy with world building again, that you really, you're just gonna show the tip of it,
right?
But when you add all these little bits and pieces into it, it's it hints at so much more depth. You don't have to describe it all in detail. You can get so much out of it anyway.
Yeah. And, as you said, I had forgotten about that element of it. But, of course, the implication is that even as all this stuff is going on with, John and Danny and so on, somewhere out in Y'ti, there's some dude or some woman in the same basic position, presumably, if all this stuff is true. This is so cool to me. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I was just sort of, yeah, saying, yeah, it's a really fascinating a way of looking at it. It makes the world a lot bigger.
Right, right. And I'd always liked that about, you know, an argument that I've made repeatedly, you know, about the sort of long discursions into Essos that take place in the series is that, you know, okay, so it's not the Seven Kingdoms in the main, it's not the characters that we know best or the culture that we know best, but I always thought that was really vital to the book's overall project, because, you know, when you learn about what's going on in Volantis, let's say, with the tigers and the elephants, or the various groups jockeying for control in Karth or whatever, the point is that the proverbial Game of Thrones is going on everywhere. And, you know, we're getting this, I always thought the message there is that, like, you know, sure, we're focusing on Westeros, but, you know, these events going on in these other cities mean just as much to the people who live there as the stuff going on in King's Landing and Winterfell and so on, and the Wall mean to the people who live in Westeros. And then to see that get blown up even further into having this sort of the supernatural, you know, a apocalyptic element of the storyline also play out in other places, I thought, it was really rewarding, not just from like the Easter egg perspective of how fucking cool it is, but, you know, just also in terms of getting, you know, readers to think about the universality of these experiences with power and violence and stuff like that, that drive the whole, you know, the whole project. So again, I sound like I'm just sort of blowing smoke, but, you know, just, there's a lot of elements of the books of the book that, you know, even though it kind of came together in this way because of various necessities, for yeah. what can be said, like it wound up working really, really well with the main project itself.
It reminds me of one of George's quotes, and I know he's maybe got him from someone else, but I mean, and it's sort of, you know, every character is a hero of their own story. It's an idea that he holds as quite important in his writing, and I think in a way this is every civilization is the hero of its own story as well. So even if we're not going to be focused on these things, if the Song of Ice and Fire is a very particular story, and these characters are just on the sidelines, or the civilization is that kind of a setting and a sideline thing. Based from their own perspective, they're the most important thing. I mean,
you could shift the focus and show them instead.
Yeah.
That's sort of the room is there that if you just change the camera angle, you'd be seeing something else instead. It's a little bit like, you know, what Kay has doing in Last Light of the Sun. Yep. In particular, where he's got these little vignettes in between the main character sections, was just showing how sort of they intersect with the main story and showing like a tiny glimpse of that character's story instead. And for just for a moment, shifting the camera angle. And you could kind of see doing that in A Song of Ice and Fire, that it's very easy to just, you switch out a character, you switch out the focus, and then you have another perspective on the story. And also because it adds to the size of the world. And this is something that George also stressed at the Royal Armory, that, you know, he doesn't want everything to be explained. I think that's one reason that he really likes the Lovecraftian elements and also Howard and such. He wants there to be, you know, this is not neat and tidy. He commented on, who's the guy who, after Lovecraft's death?
Durlith,
who went, Arthur Durlith, right? Who went through and sort of organized the Lovecraft mythos. He wants it to be, to a certain point, unexplainable. It's just a sort of beyond knowing. You can't really encompass everything into a structure. It's like with Tolkien, when you get to like the Watcher in the water.
Yeah.
Right. You don't really know where he fits into the, it's just something deep and dark and from, you know, ages past.
That's my favorite. Ever since I was a kid, I love that. Well, it's not a character. I love that monster so much for that exact reason, because it just hinted at, you know, oh my God, there's so much we don't know. It was exciting to me, you know, as a little boy, and it's still exciting to me as a 37-year-old, as an old, done man. Yeah, and I don't know. I think that's also true to real life, too. I mean, I just had a conversation with my fiancé's son yesterday. We got a magazine in the mail from the American Museum of Natural History about an upcoming exhibit they're doing on dinosaurs, you know, emphasizing the fact that a lot of the thinking now paleontologically is that they had feathers. And he was like, I don't know about that. I'm pretty sure they didn't. And it's just amazing to think of like how much we thought we knew for sure about our own very real world where you can walk around and do scientific shit and figure things out and you still don't know. Like, why wouldn't it be kind of loose and messy and mysterious and unintelligible around the fringes of this fantasy world where everything is bigger and bolder and stranger to begin with?
No, it's true. I mean, I have a bit of a tendency to like a certain amount of neatness. I'm a little bit OCD about connecting things up and such, but I can see the appeal anyway, even if my brain always likes to try and categorize things. But I also like the sense of wonder. So sometimes sort of my brain has a disagreement on that about whether it should be neatly organized or should be sense of wonder.
I'm trying to think. Stefan, was there any other like main thing that you wanted to hit?
One thing, but I'm not sure how much you can actually expand on it because it might run afoul of several embargoes you have for Martin. But it is not even that juicy. But one observation that has been made in the fandom of late is that in the Duncan Egg stories, Martin did prepare the ground for the Blackfyre Rebellion. You know, you got all those background stuff about the Blackfyres, and at the point when the Duncan Egg novellas came out, it wasn't entirely clear why we were supposed to know all this stuff. And then came A Dance with Dragons, and suddenly, oh yeah, that's why we need to know all of this. And my question would be, is the Will of Ice and Fire, at least in parts, for example, for the Deep Ones, fulfilling the same function? So would you say, you don't even need to go into details if you aren't allowed to, but is there something in there that might become more important later on that when you know it from the book leads to this, oh, I understand the story on a deeper level than I would if I hadn't read the book?
Now, is it specifically about the Deep One aspect or some just any aspect of the World of Ice and Fire, which is...
Both.
There are things, I think, in the World of Ice and Fire, which I think George intends to provide a little thrill of recognition in readers when they come across something in future novels.
I don't know about the groundwork for anything as major, like scale of the Blackfyre Rebellion.
I don't think like I personally, like, we never really even discussed the Deep One stuff with George. Like, we just, we recognize what he was doing with in terms of love, you know, homage to Lovecraft and just playing with the sense that there's these deep mysteries, like, that the Maesters are completely clueless about, or they don't know anything about it, and, like, you guys don't know anything about it. But there are other things which I think supposed to be. Some things I think maybe more in a sense of sort of parallels. Like people have said, you know, are there parallels between sort of the conflicts leading into the Dance of the Dragons and characters of like Daemon Targaryen? Are there parallels between his story and that of characters in the present? Maybe George may be touching on sort of thematic similarities.
I mean, I guess we can say that there wasn't anything that, you know, in regards to those sort of laying the groundwork that George specifically told us not to discuss or such.
No.
So there wasn't anything that he, you know, he might have then decided to keep it quiet from us by not drawing
our attention to it,
but I certainly got the impression that he may have been inspired to write things, some of the historical events, and then thinking, this would make a nice parallels. I forget, there was one thing in particular that popped into my mind as a potential parallel. I think it might have to do with something about Daeron the Young Dragon and Young Griff, that I thought was sort of a parallel in, the fact that he has a similar wording for when Daeron tells the nobles of King's Landing that, you know, we should go and invade Dorne, and, you know, you have a dragon, he stands before you, and it sort of, for me, echoes a little bit how he has, Aegon present himself to the Golden Company.
Right.
Whether that is, and, you know,
intentional
that he wants to parallel anything more about the two, or, but I think he got ideas of having little resonances between historical events and,
At the same time, it could be unintentional. It says, like, George, there are certain things that draw him, and there are certain things he likes writing about. So maybe if there's a resonance, it's more about, it resonates to the level of how he creates and what he finds interesting. It's not necessarily deliberate, but it's like, you know, questions of, you know, who has power, or how do you measure power? Who's the one who really decides who's powerful? These things may reflect themselves in the narrative as well. Yeah. I mean, he embraced the whole Maester thing when he did Gildane's account of the Dance of the Dragons, because he's got Gildane himself referencing three different sources for his own work. So he's got, you know, the Septon, he's got the Grand Maester, and he has the Fool. And they all provide very different narratives about, in some cases, about events that happened, you know, for them. They were contemporaneous events, and yet they each have very different accounts, because the Septon has a very faith-based view of things. Do the gods approve or not of this person? Was this person godly or not? And the Grand Maester is, you know, a detail that we didn't get around to mentioning, is, I mean, he was in jail, possibly to be, you know, tried and executed when he was writing his account. And is he trying to make himself look as good as possible? And how does that color his narrative? And the fool is, yeah, Mushroom was something special.
Mushroom's my hero.
He has his own thing going on, and you have no idea. Like, I think we're the ones who introduced the line where our Maester says, you know, half the things you can't believe, and the other half you kind of wish you couldn't believe because they were so outrageous. So I think a lot of it is just resonances that George has. Yeah. But George didn't, like, the deep one in particular, like, there's nothing but we discussed. So I can honestly say, like, if George has intentions to somehow reference this or use this in the novels, we're as clueless as everybody else is on that point.
I'd love to know more about, you know, particularly the line about there being no children or animals. That one, that really gets my imagination going. And, you know, if you were to revisit that in some fashion, or, you know, just who built the citadel and when, that would be, or, you know, the sea stone chairs, all of these things. Like, you know, if we get anything more, I'll, you know, be eating it up gladly.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, it gives me the chills thinking about it, some of it. The sea stone chair, oh, so cool. You know, but I just thought of another kind of neat effect of the way this works, is that, you know, there are resonances that may just be because of George's interests, and there are resonances that may be because he's trying to set up, you know, direct narrative parallels. But there's also probably resonances where more recent characters are shaping their behavior and thinking about people that they know from the histories that they've read. Like, you know, the young Griff example is a case in point. Like, surely he's read, you know, the story of the young dragon. And, you know, as a lot of young men seem to do in Westeros, find him, like, completely heroic and awesome, and is modeling his personality after him to a certain extent.
That's actually a very good point. I mean, they go on about how he's been well-educated and such, so Daeron's, you know, conquest of Dorne would
certainly be
on the curriculum, yes. Yeah. And one could certainly see that having had a bit of an influence. He seems to be a bit of a bold young fellow, and maybe he didn't finish Daeron's conquest of Dorne.
Yeah, I guess he should have made sure he saw how that one ended.
Yeah.
Oh, well. But, you know, this is a story that is, in a lot of ways, about the influence of stories, now that I think about it. You know, I've written, I think, what, you know, some of the first stuff that I ever really wrote about A Song of Ice and Fire was talking about Sansa and Bran, and how, you know, Sansa kind of got a drubbing for, you know, the way early on in the story she was so obsessed with tales of, you know, princesses and, you know, courtly romance and so on. But Bran's fall and subsequent, you know, life after that obscured the fact that he was in many ways just as sort of blinded by the heroic tales for boys, you know, about knights and adventurers and things. And you know, meanwhile, you have Melisandre, who is so convinced that she's living out, you know, this ancient story again, that she's, like, repeatedly fucking up the world, you know, in an effort to make, to push that forward. So
narratives are how existing narratives affect your own narrative, how you kind of shape your own narrative, how you might shape narratives around you. You're expected to be a certain thing. You know, you've got characters like the Hound, who is rebelling, tries to rebel completely against what he's supposed to be.
Right.
And throwing that narrative aside entirely. And then you've got all the different narratives about what happened in Robert's Rebellion and who exactly, you know, is there a right narrative? And so, no, George, I think, is very aware of, in particular, taking the multiple point of view structure approach of how you can play around with different narratives and the power of narratives in, you know, a layered sort of a narratives affecting the character's own narrative, because, you know, yeah, you can say a lot about that, I think.
It's funny. I feel like I like the book even more now than when we started talking like 45 minutes ago. Something about the nature of the setting really makes this work in a way, you know, for all the reasons that we've talked about, it really makes it work, not just as a reference, but like as you know, like, I can't think of the right word for it, but you know, as an artistic expression of the setting, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
I can see that. It was such a, you know, honor and privilege of just to be involved. I mean, George asking me out of the blue, like, you guys gotta write this with me, and you know, the trust he had was enormous. I mean, we were just fans who had a website, basically, is all he knew of us at the time.
I guess he had seen that you could string two sentences together on the website, basically.
Yeah, I knew a lot, but it's just been an amazing ride, and it's, I think we're there. I find it very hard. Like, one of the things I've told people is, like, you know, I have a great amount of knowledge about the novels, right? And that's like part of the thing that George was impressed by. But like, there are people who know this book way better than we do, who have probably reread it and gone through. And I know where people have poured through it, because once you've actually written something, it can be really hard to go back and like look at it yourself and just try to treat it like a fan. I can't treat it like I'm just a fan now. I just want to read about the world of the fire, because I wrote it, and like every page to me is like, oh, I wish I had written it in this way. Why did I use that phrase? Oh, I repeated this phrase. Why didn't we catch that? Yeah. Here's a new mistake I need to tell Anne about to see if we can get it corrected in the future print. So
I can understand very well now the authors. I've seen a number of authors actually who've asked fans on the internet, like, you know, I'm going to write a new book in the series that I've not worked on for a while. Could you help me dig up references to certain things? Because I find it really difficult to go back and reread my own books in detail.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I definitely have a newfound understanding of what that can be like.
Yeah, now suddenly the horse that changed genders makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that's all that I had, and Stefan, do you have anything more? Or?
No, I'm also pretty much covered. It was very insightful, so thanks. Yeah.
I mean, like I said at the beginning, like, this was an episode that was, you know, a long time coming, so I'm so psyched that we got to do it finally. Thank you.
This is well, very happy.
Yeah, no, it kind of came at a good time then. We certainly wrapped up most of the press work that we ended up doing some very late last year here in Sweden, going to various libraries. We've got a couple
more left
coming this year, but it's
winding down a bit.
So. Winding down and kind of wrapping up the experience of having written a book for the first time. Whether there'll be, you never know. But for now, it's the first and only time, anyway.
Oh yeah, I guess that's a good. That would have been a good question. You know, are there future plans for you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you refer to the fact that, I mean, as we've had, George wrote a lot of material, especially about Stugarians, and like, we couldn't use it, the whole thing, so we had to, like, rephrase it and paraphrase it and bring it down to fit within the constraint of the book, because originally the book was going to be, like, 90,000 words. That was the contract said. And, like, when we wrote, we had gotten, like, 80,000 words just on, like, the who's who. It was originally going to be part of it. It was, like, a guide to the characters of the Song of Ice and Fire, and, like, that was impossible. But even after we dropped that and we just stuck strictly to the material, we had tens of thousands of words. Like, how were we going to fit in everything else? So it was very gracious of Random House to allow us to expand it to like 180,000, and we had more words than that. So the Targaryen stuff, George has said, you know, he wants to get it out in an unedited, you know, not unedited, but in the complete format of that he had written it at some point and expand it, because he stopped writing on the Targaryens right about with the Aegonfords regency. He did add some stuff he did write the Aerys material as well, actually, but between Aegon the Third's the end of the regency through to Aerys, I mean, that's, you know, us ourselves based on what he had given us and what was in the books and so on. Unfortunately, as I said, I mean, those notes that he had given us about for a game were covered much of that period anyways.
And then plus the conference call we had.
Plus the conference call with Aegon.
So that kind of helped. But he's still, you know, if he's going to publish that in Fire and Blood, he needs to finish writing those kings.
And, well, he's mentioned in an interview, he hasn't actually ever told us directly, but he said that, well, he has this idea for Fire and Blood, and he said in the interview that he was going to work with us on that one. He's never told us this, but, you know, we absolutely be happy to work with him in any capacity on that.
Yeah, you know, when the email or call arrives, you want to do this, it's like, yes, George, when do you need us?
Yeah.
And, you know, our contract allows for an updated edition of the book, but since it isn't a reference work, you know, from A to Z, it's not a straightforward thing to, you know, update it as, you know, more books come out. I'm not strictly sure what, you know, if, you know, Eandel would have to publish some, addendums or what. It's a hard sell for me to see how we would update it in a way that is useful for people and not just providing like a new edition with some small corrections and tweaks, and I'm not sure about that. But
yeah, I'm not sure about it either.
So we'll see what happens with it. But I think Fire and Blood is more likely, provided that you know, George doesn't feel that once he's done with Song of Ice and Fire, that he prefers to do, you know, Duncan Egg and other things to start with.
Right. Right. Well, until then, I guess, you know, Maester Yandel is not your bitch, to paraphrase Neil Gaiman.
Indeed.
Well, if he's alive, you know. George was being a bit ominous about that at Archipelagon. He asked us, so, you know, where is Yandel these days? And, you know, he's kind of,
I said in my head, Yandel's sitting there every day showing up to be given an audience with the king to present the book, and every day he's told, nah, not today, maybe next week, whatever.
The king is dead.
The king is dead. Sorry,
wait for the next one.
Yeah. But then he said, oh, you know, he might lose his head.
And so,
well, it's always a possibility, especially if the person who's on the throne by the time he finally presents it is like the person who would like hate some of the things he wrote about, say, the Targaryens or or, yeah, you know, who's slighted Ned Stark by not mentioning him, what have you. So, we'll see if he makes an appearance. It would be kind of cool if he did somehow, oh, wow, like, yeah, even in the background.
Oh, yeah, he gets the prologue for,
yeah, perfect.
Hopefully, dies.
Hopefully he's not flowing through the veins of Sir Robert Strong as we speak. Well, thank you so much, really, for joining us. You know, the two of you, your support has meant a lot to me and to us over the years, and so I'm so glad we got to have you on and talk to you about the book, which I really
do. Likewise, it's been fun talking with you guys about various aspects of the books, and we'll see.
I'm currently being assaulted by a boxer.
Yeah, whenever you want to talk about this, so we're happy to chat.
Yes, absolutely.
Reed as well will be happy to chat, apparently.
Yeah, he seems a bit slighted that he was not interviewed, but you were just moral support guy.
Well, it's provided,
not even that.
Provided he hasn't mauled you to death in revenge, that we'll be happy to have you back on sometime. Yes. Soon, so.
And, you guys have a good one, then.
You too. Yeah. Thank you, and thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.